Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray and I'm here with Ian Hislop, the magazine's editor, Helen Lewis and Matt Muir. We're going to be talking about the latest news in all sorts of areas shortly. And in the second half of the show, we'll be talking to my colleague Heather Mills about a really fascinating scandal, the stem cell scandal at the Royal Free she's been writing about recently. But first, I gather we have an apology. It's actually not an apology from me, I should say. Solomon Hughes claimed that you, Ian, were entirely responsible for the Turd of the Week feature and had in fact made it ruder than he'd initially wanted it to be.
Yes, I mean, Solomon, as soon as I go away for one episode of the podcast, says he wanted to call it Discharge of the Week and make it a serious environmental story. And I just said I want it to be Turd of the Week and I want a picture of whichever head of the water board it is with a turd emoji. Now, that bit is true, but I'm just saying other people thought it was funny as well. And to put a picture of, say, Heidi Mottram, who was the head of Northumbrian Water, next to a turd emoji and say, Heidi Mottram pictured left, I still think is funny. So that's all I've got to say. And Solomon, who is not sadly available for this podcast, or indeed ever again, is not here to deny it. So thank you for that.
So it's kind of non-apology from everybody of the week, and there'll be more turds of the week in future, is what you're saying.
Yes, and also Heidi was the first woman turd to get the award. We've had
Peter Simpson. Very much breaking the turd ceiling. Lovely.
The round ceiling.
Oh, my God. Okay, maybe before we get any deeper into this. Yeah, let's go to some actual news stories. So, Matt, you're here partly because you write a lot about tech, AI, and there's a hugely exciting rebrand, even more exciting maybe than Heidi Mottram's rebranding as Turd of the Week, which is Twitter becoming X.
Can I just start by saying how much I hate Elon Musk for making me pay so much attention to him? And yep. what should be a very, very, very boring non-story. Company changes name. Doesn't feel like it should dominate the news page and the news cycles. But Elon Musk has at least three talents, one of which is attracting all of the world's press attention to him at any given moment. So this has been on the cards for a while. So when in October of last year, Elon Musk said that his purchase of Twitter was an accelerant towards his dream of creating X, the everything app. And then in April, he incorporated Twitter into X, which is a company that he had previously owned. So Twitter technically hasn't existed as a company for about 4 months now. So he has now rebranded it to X officially. And the question as to why he's done this. So the boring and probably factual answer is that since 1999, when Elon Musk founded a company called X.com in the States, which was designed to be a sort of banking and payments provider, but he had always said that was going to be the universal financial services app, the everything app, as he claimed it. He then partnered with some other people, including Peter Thiel, whose company had come up with very similar technology via their offshoot PayPal. These companies merged. And then basically everyone else in this company kicked Elon Musk out because they hated him. There's a wonderful quote here from Elon back in the day where he says that X is the coolest URL on the internet. Now, take a moment. Take a moment. This man was, I believe, already 28, 29 years old at the time. Surely at the age of nearly 30, one should have grown out of the belief that the letter X is somehow imbued with this magical property that makes everybody fall in love with you if you use it.
I think there's one way to understand Elon Musk, and it's basically ask yourself in a situation, what would a 13-year-old boy do? Right? So the whole thing is that he has named it X because then he's now renamed the boardrooms inside Twitter with names like Sexy with a big X in it, right? Like that's the whole... He's like a kid writing boobs on a calculator. That is basically the only way to understand it.
It's exactly like that. And the kind of mad thing about this is that the kernel of this idea is that X will eventually, and this is something that he's been trying to do via a medium of levers, primarily in the States, with attempts to get licensing for banking transfers and things like that. He wants X to fundamentally become much like, say, WeChat is in China. WeChat is effectively a kind of mixture of Facebook and PayPal and WhatsApp that Chinese people use pretty much for everything. You pay things through it, you transfer money to your friends, relatives, the government surveils you, all of these wonderful things.
Is that the important bit?
That's the really important bit. But anyway, so the idea is that all of your financial services, in fact, your entire life will go through this. Now, it strikes me as questionable whether the vanishing number of people who actually want to use Twitter, let alone pay Elon Musk $8 a month or upwards for the privilege of so doing.
Are people staying with it? Are they going off to Threads, which I've moved all my my accounts there.
I really loved all those pictures of you in by the pool, just saying, you know, blessed, family's everything. A lot of people tried out Threads, which is from Meta, the Facebook parent company, basically because it was very easy if you had an Instagram account just to say, and I'll sign up for this too. And it was what the brands really liked it, because it was a very safe space that wasn't full of, you know, Nazis and sort of like race bait content. But it was also incredibly boring. So it looks like a lot of people sampled it and then went, actually, I don't really think, feel like I need this in my life.
I've written a little question for the three of you here. I'm not quite sure what I was thinking when I wrote this. Is this Brexit for the internet? Basically, there has been a long movement to globalization of content. Everyone from every direction was in Twitter, and it meant you could see a lot of stuff you hated or that you loved, and you could argue with everybody. And now there is a kind of fragmentation, and you've got a kind of, you know, grand duchy here and a little, you know, micro statelet there and a micronation here. And it's gradually splintering, and we're going to have a Holy Roman Empire situation before long.
If by that you mean that because of the weird caprice of somebody with a long-standing grudge, all of our experience has been made marginally worse, then yeah, it's almost exactly like Brexit, I think. That's okay. A really good analogy. Well done.
You had me at Holy Roman Empire. I was instantly going, who is the Pope in this situation? Mm. Who is Charles VII? Who hasn't got enough grandparents, you know, and has got a weak jaw? The weird thing about Elon Musk about this idea about him wanting to run this big app is that he talks a big game about being kind of libertarian and capitalist, but both he and Peter Thiel of PayPal have throughout their careers relied on really big government contracts, right? Palantir and Thiel's companies have relied on these big Defense Department contracts. SpaceX nearly went bust and was rescued by winning a couple of massive NASA contracts. So there is this weird thing that he wants to usurp the functions of government, but by doing it in this nimble, agile capitalist way, which is always slightly, when you scratch the surface, not quite as advertised, I would say.
So he's basically subsidised throughout.
Well, yeah, I think that's fair. You know, the basic theory of Tesla is that you get credits, tax credits for selling electric cars because governments are putting so much money into the energy transition. So, you know, you can't really tell that story without a very favourable tax environment in the US. And honestly, like SpaceX came within, what, days, Matt, of going bust?
It was literally days. If it hadn't been for the fact that he was kicked out of what was then X.com by Peter Thiel and others, the company had, again, not long, because Musk was running it into the ground with his obsession with this X thing. So this image of him as a visionary business genius who, you know, give him enough rope and he will run it around the world 17 times and electrify it to boot is possibly somewhat unwarranted. Don't get me wrong. Like, the fact that he has made electric cars worldwide a thing is an incredible achievement, and he has changed the course of human history in some way as a result of so doing. I don't think that equates to him, as I think the past year has proven, being able to turn shit into gold wherever he may step.
For those of us who didn't think Twitter was terribly great to start with, has he made it worse?
You can see it in a couple of ways. The first is that the verification system being removed from, you know, brand accounts and stuff like that, it means it's much harder to see who is genuinely trustworthy in a kind of breaking news situation. Something that looks like ABC News tweets about something, you have no idea really if it's the real one anymore.
It's also important to point out the hate speech issue, because this is another contentious one. So obviously, Twitter no longer being a public company means that it doesn't have to provide data about any of this stuff. And Musk's principle of hate speech has always been freedom of speech, but not freedom of reach. So the idea being that on Twitter now, you are entitled, based on the platform's laws, to say probably more bad things, bad inverted commas, obviously, than you were previously under the old regime. The difference now being is that, according to Elon Musk, tweets with bad things in them will be less visible via algorithmic suppression than they might have been otherwise. Which means that Elon Musk, as he has done consistently throughout the course of his ownership of the company, has been saying things like, well, hate speech is down, we've eliminated so much of it. And firstly, that's impossible to check because he doesn't have to publish any data about this. Secondly, it's impossible to check because all of the data that third-party fact-checkers used to check to verify this stuff, they can't afford anymore because he's jacked up the API prices. And thirdly, which is the crucial thing, now, anybody who uses Twitter and is part of a group of people who regularly attracts opprobrium online, and some of you as journalists may be aware of this phenomenon.
I am familiar with the one you're talking about, yes.
We'll have noticed that the volume of terrible things that people say to you on Twitter hasn't diminished. In fact, some might argue that it has got larger.
It used to be like a larger... Here's another Andy analogy time. It used to be like a large open field... With lots
is
of.
Is it going to be a regular feature?
I'm afraid it is, yeah. It used to be more like a speaker's corner, you know, you get a lot of weird stuff going on, but there was a lot, and, you know, 100 flowers are blooming and all of this. And now it's a little bit more like a kind of worrying petrol station late at night. You just need to get in, pay for the petrol, buy a Lion Bar, get out. That's it. You sort of pop in rather than anything else.
Yeah, I always thought of it like being like a pub. And it is like, now it is like a pub. Just slightly after closing time, someone's just snapped a pool cue in half.
All right. Well, speaking about free speech brings us very nicely on to the next subject we've got. It's maybe the most important story happening in the entire world at the moment. It is, of course, Nigel Farage's banking arrangements. And this has prompted mass resignations, huge campaigns, lots and lots of attention, which obviously Nigel Farage is very, very good at getting. Unfortunately, on this occasion, it seems like he's got a point. Ian, you want to step up and defend him, I believe.
Well, no, I'm just incredibly angry about the whole issue, because it appears that Farage is right, which is just not what I want to read. And having ploughed for, you know, years through this stuff about freedom of expression and used as a flag for the right to get very excited, it seems that in this case they have a point. And I don't want that. I do not want to read sympathetic pieces where Nigel Farage is presumed to be right. And to be honest, on this one, initially no one wanted to believe it. And most commentators said, well, I bet he hasn't got enough money, which is obviously what was the inference of the head of NatWest at that infamous charity dinner. And we thought that would be good. Or some of us were hoping that perhaps there'd be some issue of Russia Today's money, or, you know, none of these things are true. But it's what we were all hoping. And the truth is, he was right. And I find that very, very annoying.
We should say that just for any listeners who haven't been reading the front page of the Daily Telegraph for the last fortnight, it's that there was a dinner at which the chief executive, Alison Rose, briefed a BBC journalist called Simon Jack. She said, no, the reason he was chucked out was because he didn't have the requisite either 1 million or 3 million pounds in investments or savings. So that's why. And then he checked that with her. She said, absolutely, you can run that. And it wasn't true. And Helen, you've been reading the dossier that Coutts had prepared on Nigel Farage, and I believe it makes very interesting reading.
Yeah, it does. It doesn't leave you with the best view of Nigel Farage when you read all this stuff together about why he doesn't like watching women's football because it's rubbish and why women deserve to be paid less. But, you know, there's stuff in there like his opposition to net zero, right, which is, you can agree or disagree with it, but that is a legitimate political position agreed with lots and lots of people in this country. And there is stuff about him not, you know, attacking Black Lives Matter as a Marxist organisation. As Ian says, there is some mention of Russia connections, particularly the name Aaron Banks is redacted throughout. But it also points out we've never been able to find anything. He's not been convicted of anything. He's not been sanctioned. You know, he left his Russia Today show in 2017. So, you know, they just don't really find anything on him, apart from the fact there's this phrase that comes up about he's not compatible with our inclusive policies, you know, we might not agree with him, which is kind of fascinating that you know, that your bank is kind of presuming to rule on what your opinions on climate change or whatever it might be, or like the particular transition towards, you know, towards energy efficiency might be. So yeah, once you come away from that dossier thinking, God, he's had some terrible opinions in his life, you also come away thinking this is not a reason to deny someone banking. My slight concern is that I felt like has he been debanked so much as downbanked?
I don't like the word debanking, and I'm annoyed that we all know it now. But, you know,
he's rather debagging.
Yes, that's it
seems a very old-fashioned word, very Coots somehow.
Debanked
we don't like
radished.
Your record, yeah. And we're debagging you, Nigel.
I didn't know that about him thinking that women should be paid less, although I guess he has ensured that at least one woman is being paid much, much less now. So,
well, yeah. I don't know. She's getting some vast payoff, I think. So I don't think even that has worked.
Yeah, he said because they go away and have babies, they just are objectively worthless. So right. Should we really worry about the gender pay gap? But again, I find it an annoying opinion. I would like to have a small row with him about it, but it's not necessarily a reason to kick him out of his bank.
Yes, but down banking am I right in saying he was told he could still have an account at NatWest?
But only a personal account, not a business account.
Right.
And I think there are a couple of things that are legitimate problems here. One is about 1 million people in Britain don't have a bank account, and you are supposed to be guaranteed by 9 banks that they will give you access to quote-unquote basic banking services. Now, this is a huge problem, not least among people like refugees, for example. You know, they just simply cannot get these bank accounts. And one of the other things that comes up again and again in these stories that did happen to Farage is that you don't get told why. Your bank just goes, sod off, and you go, why? And they go, don't care. Now, obviously, not everybody then has recourse to not just phoning the manager. And little did I know that the super option was to go straight to the chief exec and demand satisfaction. But yeah, so I find it difficult because, as Ian says, there are times in which he's sympathetic. And I think this flags up a wider issue.
And he wanted to belong to Coutts. So it is a certain sort of snobbery that he wanted. And you know, some of us who do bank at Coutts thought their basic problem was you don't have frightful spibs like Nigel having accounts at Coutts. I thought that's what the unwritten rule was. But it appears to be stuff about discrimination and inclusivity, which, again, if you want to buy into snobbery and they won't have you, it does end up being quite funny.
Right, it's basically Coutts is operating like a private members club and it is doing what private members clubs do, which is say you're an awful rotter and we won't want to be associated with you. That does make me think if you've got a Coutts account, you should have a subject access request. That's got to be quite fruity. I would recommend anybody who thinks that they've been wronged by a company issue a subject access request.
You should say what
that is. So it's basically you apply under Freedom of Information legislation, data protection legislation, to find out everything that they've been discussing about you.
So Ian, you're saying you've never bumped into him around the potted plants, around the rare aquarium?
No, with a marvellous carp. Chaps in bowler hats. No, I think they've scrapped them. Anyway, no, totally missed him. But I was interested in the argument about him afterwards because there was, you know, people immediately saying, well, you know, a private company can do what it likes and it can't. I mean, you know, if you've got a house to rent, you're not allowed anymore to put up signs saying no dogs, no Irish, no blacks. You know, there is an argument here and everyone always brings up the gay bakers. No, they were Christian bakers, and they were anti.
The cake was gay, the bakers weren't.
Weren't. Yeah. Thank you. Thank goodness I've got people here to pick me up on detail. But on that issue, UKIP at one point came out entirely behind the right of the private baking company to refuse business, which it did not approve of. And UKIP, in a pledge, said, you know, the right to refuse to carry out certain tasks, we will make that core UKIP policy. Now, one of those tasks that you may not want to carry out is having a bank account for Nigel Farage. So there is a slight contradiction here. And I think that's why this debate turned interesting.
From what I'd understood, the crux of the story here is that Coutts asserted that there would be a point at which Farage had disposed of his mortgage with them, that he would not technically meet the threshold, but it was at their discretion whether or not customers were able to continue banking with Coutts, and they would then at that point not exercise that discretionary right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they said when his mortgage finished, they would put him on a glide path to exit, which sounds like a euphemism for like euthanizing him. He's going to put you on a glide path to the pillow of your face. But yeah, exactly right. They could have maintained it, but they said, we think there's a reputational risk in being associated with him. However, we also think he might, quotes, go public. And guess what? They were, in fact, right about at least one of those things.
So in many respects, this is as much a story as it is about Farage, free speech and banking rights, as it is about a PR department massively fucking things up.
Oh, definitely. Putting it all down in emails, I think that's the thing. People haven't really caught up with the idea of subject access requests yet and what it is that people are entitled to do. I also do feel slightly that people are being a little bit played on this because it is very much in Farage's interest to stoke kind of fears about the banking system. Now, some of those are entirely correct, right? But he has been, up until last year, he had a daily, you know, newsletter in which he would regularly plug not only gold and silver, but Bitcoin, right? So he's very much on that. You can't trust the elite. You can't trust the globalists. That's what he called Grant Shapps. You know, you can't trust the banking economy. Kind of either put it all in Bitcoin that no one can control, brackets, it's definitely not a pyramid scheme, or put it all in gold, you know, where at least you can touch it and know where you are.
Can we just point out, by the way, that he was also charging £200 annually to subscribers of that fantastic newsletter? I'm not entirely sure.
Fortune and Freedom, it was called.
Fortune and Freedom.
It ended in 2022. I went and looked it up. His last email appears to have been in April 2022. Headline, reports of Bitcoin's death are greatly exaggerated, which he wrote just before Bitcoin spectacularly imploded and lost about, I think, you know, two-thirds of its value.
The other slightly interesting thing is that NatWest is, what is it, 40% owned by the taxpayer? Mm. Is this why there was such a ministerial push to get rid of Alison Rose? Also, it wasn't just the chief executive, the chair resigned as well, and Farage has now slightly jumped the shark and said the entire board, maybe everybody.
Yep. The cleaning ladies should go, all of them, the whole
place. All branches to be closed and turned into trendy wine bars immediately.
Yeah, old-fashioned pubs.
That was the political element to it was an interesting one as well.
That is a bit I find uncomfortable. Much as I find uncomfortable banks sitting in moral judgment on perfectly legal opinions, yeah. I also find the government dictating to banks what, and private companies generally what they should do a dangerous road to go down. And you're right, there does seem to have been a moment when it seemed like Alison Rose could stay on and she still had the confidence to chair Howard Davies, and then suddenly Rishi Sunak did a tweet and then, she's on a way out now, which again is not a trend I would necessarily like to encourage.
No.
But is this a case of when Farage says, ooh, woke, Rishi Sunak says, oh, woke, is that, well, oh, yes, that's it, that's where the votes are, banks are woke. I mean, it's a sort of pathetic Me Too response, isn't it?
Is anyone keeping a running list of all the things that are woke currently and when they started being woke?
It's everything.
Stop being, it's everything.
There's a small corner of a forgotten field that is not woke,
are
but
you
everything
woke?
Else is woke. Yeah, yeah, well, I'm woke, yeah, yeah.
That reminds me, actually, the Daily Mail did publish a woke list, which
yesterday,
so you could
yeah.
still get onto if you apply now.
Did you notice how white it was? No diversity. It was very disappointing.
Righteous.
The thing is, he's got lots of other business interests. So as well as Fortune and Freedom, which we just mentioned,
not OnlyFans. That's an unpleasant joke. Cameo, which is a platform that enables celebrities, and it's a very loose definition, anyone who's ever been on television in America or in the UK, to charge to read out a personalised message of support to anybody who chooses to pay the money. And I think for the princely sum of, I think, 50 quid, you can make Nigel Farage read out literally anything you tell him to. And he will then send you a video of it. I'm not suggesting that anyone use this for comedy or inappropriate means, but you might want to.
Is he allowed to refuse? Is there a point at which you can de-cameo someone?
I'm not entirely sure whether Nigel is yet to receive a request so demeaning, belittling or moronic that it has not passed his threshold.
Yes, I speak as someone who's watched his show in which he got Right Said Fred on to do I'm Too Sexy and started stripping off to it and then the screen went blank.
So it is OnlyFans.
I don't know, I'd ask you about that, about wokeness, actually, because we have seen Rishi Sunak 3.0. This time he's in Margaret Thatcher's Land Rover.
So exciting. This was another Telegraphy thing, at the risk of this being a Telegraph podcast, but Rishi's latest rebrand. He was pictured at the wheel of Margaret Thatcher's old Rover, being interviewed about how he's on the side of the motorist, and, you know, despite being, I think, a helicopter guy, really. You know, he was, and it was a really, really horrible image of just, you know, this is, we're just going to, I'm going to put on Harold Macmillan's old moustache now and talk. I mean, just, this is an example of, like, please come up with something new. But anyway, he was trying to rebrand himself, as he has been for the last couple of weeks since the Uxbridge by-election, as, you know, Mr. Anti-Woke, Mr. Drill Baby Drill. He's Sarah Palin now. He's granting hundreds of new oil and gas licenses. He is ready. He is ready to declare war on the war on motorists, you know. So it is a funny kind of rebrand, and it's, yeah, it doesn't sit well with him.
It just doesn't work with him at all.
No.
Every time I see him, I mentally put him in a little kind of cap and shorts and a blazer with a school crest on, right? My mind just effortlessly photoshops that onto him. Whereas someone like James Cleverly is now Foreign Secretary, can do the kind of blokey Clarkson, Beery, whatever. It just looks such a put-on when Rishi Sunak does it that I'm not sure. But it does bespeak a certain level of desperation in the Conservatives about his quotes-unquote narrow path to victory in the next election, right? Which is supposed to be through basically offshore, you know, more gas and oil drilling in the North Sea, an end to low traffic neighbourhoods, and, you know, fights campaigning against ULEZ because of the by-election in Uxbridge went the wrong way by 500 votes, you know?
The low traffic neighbourhoods thing is so funny. As in, this is not the grand, you know, century-spanning policy that we are maybe hoping we might get from the Conservative Party. It's pretty
small beer. I came back from 2 weeks in Greece, which is frying, and we're arguing about about ULEZ and whether it's not only whether it's being implemented properly and whether people are being given sufficient compensation, but suddenly it's the whole idea of any green policy at all ever being rubbish. I mean, this is fairly fast in the course of a 2 week holiday and seems to have been predicated entirely on only losing two out of the three possible seats. And this is suddenly a brilliant new policy. And the same, I mean, you've written about Starmer's sort of iron control, but suddenly Starmer is thinking, well, perhaps I'd better drop the green stuff as well because we only won one seat hugely.
But it's a seat that the Conservatives have never, ever lost. When Tony Blair won in 1997, the Conservatives held Uxbridge.
People are always looking for the equivalent of Blair's Mondeo man or Vauxhall man, and this appears to be old banger man who's got some really terrible old van. And if that is the only target now...
Well, it's like how Jeremy Corbyn didn't win because it turns out that there aren't actually 20 million Marxist academics from North London across the UK. There probably aren't 20 million old banger men and women.
Well, returning from the continent and seeing the headline, by-election fallout, where I was in the Peloponnese, the actual ash cloud was dropping ash on you in the mornings, which made being on holiday... I mean, this is a bit of a first world problem, so... Do feel obliged not to sympathise. But it was a reminder that the slightly weird brown-coloured sky and ash dropping on your head might be more important than ULEZ when you got back.
Yeah, I also think you're right, Matt, in the sense that the problem with ULEZ is about the £12.50 a day charge. It's a hell of a lot for people whose business relies on it or who can't get their kids to school without the car. But it also comes on top of the cost of living crisis, right? So if people can't afford £12.50 a day for this, that is true. I'm sure there are lots of people that it applies to. But not least because the general economic situation after now 13 years of a Tory government is so grim. And they'd like to talk about the first bit, but not so much about the second bit, yeah. I think.
And didn't the Treasury turn down Khan's request for more money to make ULEZ fairer and offer more compensation? So it's not entirely black and white, is it?
I think what the Conservatives sometimes do is they announce a deadline, 2050 net zero, 2030 cars. They don't do a huge amount to get the world to that deadline or to get the country there. And they say, this deadline is a nightmare. Who thought of this? We better cancel this. That's a vote winner.
Yes, lots of these policies really either date back to Boris Johnson or David Cameron. So it's not like they were opposition policies. They were previous iterations of the Tory party's policies. And that is the kind of thing when you're trying to deal with something as huge as climate change, about the fact that you can't even agree with the party, your own party of 2 years ago. It becomes very difficult, which is, again, why, you know, there is a big backlash over the kind of suggestions that they might scrap the ban on sales of petrol and diesel cars from 2030. Because all of the car manufacturers are obviously betting very heavily on selling lots and lots of electric vehicles. They want that level of stability and acknowledgement that there's going to be a market for these vehicles. So you kind of can't try and trim and trab depending on whether or not you think you've got no election winning issues that you're on the right side of. That just seems incredibly short-termist.
But we all laughed at David Cameron from going for Hug a Husky to drop the green crap. But it took him a couple of years, didn't it? I mean, Rishi's done it in 2 weeks.
Thank you so much, Ian, Matt and Helen. Now, for the second half of today's show, we are turning to the In the Back section of the magazine, where a fascinating story has been developing about the misuse of stem cells. We're going to get into all the science in a minute. The basic headline is about donated cells being misused and ending up with the first bit of this story in a private Harley Street clinic being applied to patients in various ways by a doctor called Aymer Khan. Heather has been writing about Dr. Khan and the whole tangled saga for some time now. So I started off by asking her exactly how he first came to her attention. Here's Heather.
We were first alerted to him actually quite before this stem cell arose. And that was to do with a charity he was running called Back on Tracks for injured service personnel.
Okay.
And he was drawn to our attention because he was using the charity to promote products he was selling and stood to benefit from. And on a charity, yeah, you're not allowed to do that. He wasn't declaring a financial interest. So that was our first encounter with Dr. Khan.
Okay.
And then it was noticed that on his website, he was also promoting, quotes, stem cell treatments for all sorts of things, from erectile dysfunction to Parkinson's disease to, you name it, almost. It was a kind of treat-all.
Yeah. And can I just ask there?
Yeah.
For listeners who might have been a while since GCSE biology, stem cells.
Right.
Can we say what they are?
Yes.
Yeah.
We read about these wonderful things called stem cells. And I think everybody thinks that, you know, whenever you see stem cell mentioned, it is these stem cells that can reproduce into any cell in our body, you know, the building cells of our whole body. And in fact, that is true of only a small amount of the stem cells. And in fact, the real stem cells and the ones that were first identified are in human embryos, but early stage human embryos.
Okay.
So in there, you find the true stem cells. But as they mature, so as the embryo is implanted into the uterus and they then mature, they become more specific. So, you know, they enable us, you know, the specific ones we have enable us to renew our skin every month.
Yeah.
And our blood and all of those things. But the ones that actually, you know, could change into all of these things that we read about, you know, are very specific and only in early stage embryos.
So that's what proper stem cells are.
Yes. And then there are these sorts of cells, which we've been writing about, and they're not true stem cells, which is why we put them in quotation marks. They're derived from blood or fat cells or cord tissue, and they contain very little, if any, stem cells. And they're yet to be proven as a treatment for anything, let alone everything, as some of these clinics are suggesting.
Okay, so when we talk about stem cells in the context of this clinic, that's what has been passed along the chain and has ended up in these treatments.
Yes.
So Dr. Khan is offering, quote-unquote, stem cell therapies for all sorts of conditions.
Yes. So I contacted immediately Professor Patricia Murray, who's this amazing woman who's been looking into all sorts of stem, quotes, stem cell scams, not just here, but, you know, a whole range. She's been uncovering all sorts of alarming treatments and things that are being offered at exorbitant amounts of money and that potentially put, you know, patients at risk.
I suppose the question that comes from that is where Dr. Khan had acquired the stem cells in the first place, because I imagine there are quite strict rules about getting hold of stem cells and using them medically.
And so Patricia Murray, Professor Murray, immediately wanted to know what were these cells that were being offered and injected, where did they come from, because they are, you know, human tissue is supposed to be carefully regulated. And she embarked on this amazing tracking journey that took her a little bit of time to forensically go through everything. And she tracked the whole thing back to the Anthony Nolan charity.
And lots of listeners, I think, will be familiar with the Anthony Nolan charity. So if you have a baby, there will often be someone from the Anthony Nolan Trust at the hospital asking the mother if she's willing to donate the stem cells from her umbilical cord, which are used medically and which can be incredibly useful for a range of different treatments.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And the Anthony Nolan Charity, is, you know, its main effort is to save lives, basically, particularly those with blood disease and blood cancers. And this is one of the few areas where stem cell treatment really works. And that's in, there are two treatments which are generally licensed as successful stem cell treatments. And these are blood cancers. For example, your stem cells from bone marrow would be used to implant into another patient whose own cells would have been killed by chemotherapy. And then the new ones will take over and hopefully, you know, reproduce healthy blood.
So it sounds like Professor Murray had found out that there was a link between the cells being collected by the Anthony Nolan Charity.
Yes.
And the cells that were ending up in Dr. Khan's Harley Street Skin Clinic being offered for, as you say, all sorts of conditions.
Yes.
That are not these two blood cancers that they're regulated for and that they work on.
Yes. The Anthony Nolan Charity are very specific that mothers' donated tissue can only be used for ethical research and ethical treatments, you know, which are successful. But yeah, they're strict about that because clearly the mothers trust them to use their cells properly. They're certainly not for cosmetic use, which, you know, Dr. Khan and others, he's not alone. There are other clinics offering these treatments.
And the key bit of your story, I think, is this one sentence in the middle of it, which is all about this one extra use. And I'm going to quote your own story back to you here, that consenting mothers are advised that cord tissue samples are also sometimes sold on to third parties.
Yes.
For approved research, quotes, to help the charity keep the cord program running.
Yes.
And that's sort of the next link in the chain, isn't it, of how these stem cells ended up going from the charity to a Harley Street clinic.
Yes.
They weren't really regulated for.
Absolutely. Patricia tracked the cells back via this special Centre for Cell and Gene Therapy at the Royal Free Hospital. So, you know, mothers donated cords were being stored and processed at the Royal Freeze Centre.
And what was happening at the Royal Freeze Centre that allowed this loophole, if you like, or this change of use for these cells? What was behind that?
So what was behind that was complete non-scrutiny of what was going on in the cell and gene centre, basically. These cells should never have been passed on for the purposes for which they were. They should never have been sold to the Harley Street Skin Clinic. And another key player in this is Life Plus Stem Cells.
So who are Life Plus Stem Cells?
Okay, so they're another company in the chain.
Yeah.
So Professor Mark Laudel was the director of that specialist centre. He had several of his own companies operating out of the NHS facilities.
So I'm just going to check that. So he's working for the NHS, but he's also operating his own companies, which lots of doctors do, don't they? They have some public and some private practice, or some, you know, companies if they're on the entrepreneurial side of things.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, there are benefits to both if this is done properly. And it's, you know, it's not just at the Royal Free. It's happening everywhere now that you get these spin-off companies. So he had several spin-off companies sharing facilities, basically, at the Royal Free, sharing staff, sharing facilities. And this is where the whole thing got rather murky, because he wore a third hat, which was his job at University College London, where he was also working one day a week.
This is busy. This is a busy
guy. He's a very busy man.
As you pointed out, there is a potential conflict of interest here.
Serious conflict of interest, I would say, in a lot of it.
So they've set up Life Plus between them.
Yep.
At the moment, the cells have come in via Anthony Nolan, and they're at the Royal Free Hospital in this special gene centre.
Yes.
Then I'm still not clear how they end up in Harley Street.
So the next step is actually not Life Plus. So the next step is a huge multi-million international company.
Okay.
It's NASDAQ registered in the States. And there's a subsidiary over here, which is Immune Bio. So Professor Laudel signed a contract with the Anthony Nolan Trust.
Yeah.
Not only with the Royal Free, but also with Immune Bio, which is his own company.
And the cells were then, if I'm right about the order of things are going here, the cells were sold £200 per cord. Immune Bio then, you know, was permitted to use and store these cell products and commercialize the cells, but only, as you say, for approved research or licensed treatments. I'm just picturing this bundle of cells moving from a hospital where the Anthony Nolan representative has taken them, asked the mother to sign the consent form. They go to the Royal Free Hospital, and then they end up with Immune Bio or Life Plus.
So they were flogging them for all sorts of treatments as well. But as Professor Murray found, and as the inquiry report that we wrote about in the last issue found, they went via Life Plus. They were passed to the Harley Street Skin Clinic and possibly others, we don't know. And that's how they ended up being injected for all sorts of things. The most scary ones Patricia Murray found about were people who were being treated for chronic disease, like chronic lung disease, like chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, you know, for which they could not work. They never could work. And people were being charged thousands of pounds for these treatments.
It's such a remarkable story. It's such a sort of, in some ways, it's a classic snake oil story, except that the people donating at the other end of the chain have no idea where the medical products, the cells they've donated are ending up, I presume.
Yeah. No, they were exploited by the system. The NHS has been exploited by the system, if you like, because their facilities are being used for this purpose.
And the recipients of these treatments.
And the recipients are vulnerable people, you know, who've clearly exhausted, you know, other treatments perhaps, and they're desperate.
So what on earth happened next?
Well, and I mean, it's such a huge scandal, really, in that in order to be treated for these chronic diseases, you need a specials license.
Okay, can you say what that is, please?
Okay, so if a treatment is unlicensed, and it's worth bearing in mind, actually, that stem cell treatments, the only two, you know, licensed treatments that you can have, really, that are proven to work are bone marrow transplants, which I think we discussed a little bit earlier. Yeah. So for blood disease, you know, it's clearly very successful. And for skin grafts, so your stem cell, you know, your skin stem cells will repair that very well. So for other treatments, they're more experimental because they're not yet proven. Okay. And, you know, it's taken 20 years, but they are now going to clinical trials. You know, they may yet be.
So they might work, but it's
Absolutely, they might work.
And so you need a something called a specials license to carry out those treatments.
Or you go for, you know, for a clinical trial, a proper clinical trial. Right. And that's now what's happening with a lot of specific treatments for stem cells. In this case, it wasn't a proper clinical trial. So to treat these people who were ill at Harley Street, I mean, we're also talking about a GP here, Dr. Khan, treating people for conditions for which he is not a specialist. And he always told us that it was all done in conjunction with the patient's medical team. What the new report that the Royal Free carried out showed that actually sometimes these patients, consultants and doctors had no idea that their patients were being treated. And that's quite worrying. And that may be a breach of these licenses.
And what you're saying is that these specials licenses had not been secured, carried out properly in this case.
That's what the inquiry report appears to have found.
Wow.
Now, whether that all comes down to a breach of regulations, you know, is slightly unclear at the moment because the regulatory system is so complex.
It feels like there have been multiple failures here.
Yeah, multiple failures.
And multiple loopholes that have been stretched beyond the definition of loophole.
Yes. And there are so many cases, I mean, not just these, where the regulators are, you know, are looking into whether or not there have been breaches. And so, I mean, and Professor Murray's investigations, I mean, she's calling for much stronger regulation to stop this happening so that, you know, the clinics that are actually selling these should be inspected and have their own licenses, and they're not relying on the licenses of the Royal Free, for example, to treat someone in Harley Street.
What you say in the latest issue of the Mag is so striking. It's that it's about the investigation that's been carried out now. They're finding immune employees working at the Royal Free had processed the Anthony Nolan cord cells, passed them on to Life Plus, passed them on to the private sector.
Yeah.
And that's, in a nutshell, that's what's gone so wrong here.
Yes.
So both you and Professor Murray were looking into this and getting in contact with various of the parties involved. What was the sort of response?
So when Patricia Murray filed formal complaints to regulators and the hospitals, the websites went down. Fortunately, we'd done screen grabs, so, you know, we'd kept the evidence. But then, interestingly, and while investigations are going on into all of this and are still going on, Dr. Khan immediately got set up into another stem cell scam, and he is currently selling something called Goldic or iRegMed, which is mixing people's blood with some gold and then injecting it back into their bodies. And
God,
and you can, that's still happening.
Is that happening in the UK?
And not just the UK. I mean, I should stress that all of these clinics are all over, you know, they're not just in the UK, Europe, America, China, it's, you know, it's happening everywhere. But during investigations into the Goldic treatments, Dr. Khan said to a prospective patient that his earlier stem cell treatments hadn't been that effective. And he said they were also very costly, up to £100,000.
Oh, my God.
So.
More to come.
More to come.
Heather Mills there. Thanks to her, to everyone involved in the first half of this week's show. We will be back again in a fortnight with another one. Until then, thank you very much for listening. And if you'd like to get a copy of the magazine, you always can. Just go to private-i.co.uk and get your subscription today. Final thanks go to the producer of this week's show, who is, as always, Matt Hill of Rethink Audio. Bye for now.